Welcome to Kicking It with Raphael here on World Football Daily. We have an absolutely fantastic show. Guests from all over the world, Ghana, California, Europe, and of course me in Israel. Our first guest, absolute pleasure to have him on, one of the best writers in African football, Fifi Anaman, who is a football writer for All Sports Ghana and has just been tabbed as the Ghana correspondent for the Daily Telegraph out of England. So Fifi, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Rob.
It's really great to have you, and I'm very excited to be talking about this group. Before we start talking about it, I've been arguing a lot on Twitter that I actually don't think that this is the toughest group, just because I think people are, you know, to be the group of death, that means that all four teams have to be very good, and I'm not sure I'm ready to give the United States that kind of, I don't know if the word is respect. I just, you know, I think there's some tougher groups out there, but what do you think? Do you think this is the toughest group for the World Cup?
Ghana's group, I should say, is the group of death. But I think when you really look at the groups, you find that they are actually top than the ones that are now fighting from them. But ours is from a relationship perspective. I mean, you look at us, we have a long history in the World Cup, we met in 2006, we've been a quarterfinal for the Republic. And then you have that twist of Christmas, Portugal, in some way, I mean, they qualified out of their group, they were qualified, but they did manage to pull off the standard performance against Ibrahimovic Sweden, which is Brazil. So there's a sort of competitiveness with a sort of quality in competition, and I think maybe people labeling it as the group of them. It's not too far off. I mean, you have Germany in there, you have Portugal in there, and Ghana, of course, the rising force. So it might not be the toughest in any opinion, but it's the top group.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very good group, especially with Germany at the top. You know, over the last few World Cups, we keep thinking it's going to be their year. They're very, very talented, from obviously the goalkeeper position to the striking position. Fifi, in Ghana, which are people more worried about, Portugal or Germany? I mean, I think the obvious answer here is Germany, but what are people most worried about that would stop your country from advancing in the World Cup?
Fear for Ghanaians is Portugal, because everybody has kind of labeled Germany as the North factor. Everybody has sort of given up already on the Germany game, because obviously because of their quality and because of our past experience with them in 2010, we took no chance when we played that game. Even though we had moments of brilliance, but Germany is that side that has so much quality. They have that efficacy up front, they can punish you when you don't play well. So Germany is that side everyone is afraid of. And so, not so much of a concern. But if you look at Portugal, I think that is where the problem is, because most Ghanaians are looking at the fact that Cristiano Ronaldo is in that kind of form of his life, and next year is expected to be his form of a big year. And he's playing in a Portuguese side that will want to achieve something for themselves after, so many years of agony in tournaments. Remember, 2004, Germany 2006, when they lost to Senegal in the final. So, many Ghanaians are genuinely worried about Portugal because they feel they wouldn't go down without the fight. Even though, deep down, as I said on the Telegraph, people are very optimistic about qualifying because Ghana tends to do so well when stuck against the odds. But people are already labeling the US as the done deal for Ghana. But I feel even though it's that game that we have to win, I mean, that only game that you can actually foresee 3 points for Ghana. But we shouldn't take them for granted, because this is the U.S. now into a lot over the past 2 years. Under a new coach, Jürgen Klinsmann, they are playing some very good football. And I don't think leaving them at that standstill team for Ghana is very healthy. From our perspective, I think we should approach every game the sort of seriousness that we'll do every game. And who knows? I mean, we might end up beating Portugal and being beaten by the U.S. This is football, eh?
Right. I mean, anything can happen. That's the beauty of it. This is a thing that I've also been talking about on the show last couple weeks. I spoke about it after the draw. The United States, of course, has been kicked out of the tournament from your Ghanaian side 2 World Cups in a row. Now, there's a new guy in charge, obviously, with Klinsmann. You just mentioned him. A lot of players from those teams, are remember what Ghana did to the United States. I mean, you know the expression "third time's the charm." Do you think that the Americans, you know, knowing the notion that Ghana has kicked them out of the tournament, are going to have extra motivation when they face Ghana on the pitch?
Well, of course. I mean, for them, Ghana is just grudge match because, I mean, two successive tournaments in Ghana have stood in their way. And it was even more painful on their part because the first time Ghana was debutant, people didn't give Ghana, you know, quite a chance, but we ended up beating the US. And then in 2010, everyone expected, you know, Ghana making a second appearance, at least making the round of 16. And then we ended up beating the US in the round of 16. So, you know, the US would want to settle scores with that. That's very, very understandable. And it would be difficult to beat them in the third time. And I think that is what many Ghanaians are taking for granted around it, because when the draw came out, everyone was like, okay, we can beat the US, but what about Germany and Portugal? But, you know, that sense of already beating the US, I think, is very, very unhealthy from a Ghanaian perspective, because if the US side, that will capitalize on the fact that people see them as the underdogs, and people don't really give them a chance, haven't given them a chance, I should say. So they'll be coming in very strong. I mean, if you have an unknown factor, it tends to bring you to greatness. So I'm really expecting a lot from the US. Even though I think that Ghana will actually attend the job at US over the next few months.
Okay, now let's focus on your Ghanaian team. A new manager since the last 2010 World Cup, appointed in April 2012, and got his training from Manchester City. What have people's opinion been on James? Are people happy with his job so far in the last, a year and a half?
Yes. I mean, at the moment, people are really warmed up to quickly up there, because when he started, actually, people didn't give him a chance. I mean, I remember, you know, a lot of talk about how he wasn't ready because he was an assistant coach. He had never really tasted top-level management, and there were a lot of concerns whether he was the right man. In fact, halfway into Ghana's qualifiers, there were talks of replacing him with a white man because they felt he wasn't in control. I remember when he was up to Zambia, in Dola last June, there was a lot of talk about Kosi Appiah losing the job, but you have to give him credit. He's learned a lot on the job. He's proven to us that he can do the job. I mean, this is a team that went through 8 qualifiers, 8 matches left, and then they scored 25 goals. I think that is very, very impressive from a coach that we didn't expect a lot from. That's about 3 goals per game. Very, very impressive with Kosi Appiah's side. I think a side play, a ton of attacking football that happened in Ghana over the last decade, I've not seen any coach supervise the side so he's scoring, so confident in front of Guami. And he's had the advantage of introducing youngsters and debutants into the team that has helped Ghana gel up and have a great team. And he's really handled the Eagles very well. I remember in the run-up to the African Cup of Nations in South Africa earlier this year, he had issues with Andre Ayew, who's actually a star player in the team. I showed some defense. He wasn't respectful to him, and he had to drop him at the last minute. And people were expecting the feud, you know, prolonged, but Kosi Appiah showed he was a mature coach. He called a new back in place, and he has quite done the job since coming back. He actually welcomed this year, and Kevin Prince Boateng against, you know, public agreements and sort of opposition, but he still brought them back in place. Kosi Appiah has been that coach, you know, he doesn't talk much, but he knows how to get the job done. And people have a lot of confidence in going into the World Cup. Although there's still a minority of Ghanaians who think, nah, these guys are quite good. Let's teach him up. Let's make him a technical director. But I feel from the personal perspective, after monitoring Kosi Appiah to the qualifier, that he's very, very qualified to take Ghana to the World Cup.
All right, and of course, he'll have a tough task. I want to move on now and talk about Asamoah Gyan, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly because I always butcher it. But, you know, the thing we look at is players and how they're doing in their club work and how they're playing for their club. And, of course, he made, you could call it a controversial decision, Fifi, to leave England and to go to the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, where the football is not that competitive. Of course, Asama played in Italy and played in France, and then at the end played in England for Sunderland. Do you think that him playing in not a competitive football league in the United Arab Emirates will, you know, cause some problems when he's on the pitch with, you know, players from Germany and players from Portugal? Is that something that that people should worry about is that he hasn't been facing really the best competition. Also, that he left to go play in this Arab country at such a young age. I mean, usually we see players make this move, you know, in their 30s. We saw Fabio Cannavaro, of course, the Real Madrid Italian national defender, make the move. I think he went to Qatar, or maybe it also was the UAE. But is this something that should worry us, that he went to not really a good soccer division, and that's where he's been playing the last 2 years?
Yes, Rob. I mean, first of all, I think it's quite important to know that I feel Ghanaians have moved on from that sort of worry, because when some of them first made the move to go to the UAE, there were a lot of concerns about how he's chasing money rather than improving his career, because Ghana was at that point where he had great midfielders. He had two of Harry Kujar, someone by Kamehameha playing in top league questions as well, and that sort of thing. Ghanaians take pride in seeing their players playing for top clubs in Europe, and there was that point where Asamoah was peaking, and I'm talking about 2010 when he did all that he did for Ghana in the World Cup, scoring 2-3 goals in the World Cup and doing so well in the Africa Cup of Nations that played second. So everyone was expecting Asamoah to kind of make the step up from Sunderland, you know, a team like Tottenham or a mid-table team, actually, you know, just make the step up, and very soon we could see him playing for Manchester United or Chelsea perhaps. But Asamoah said, okay, I've weighed my options, I want to go to the UAE because I feel they're offering the kind of money that I feel will secure my future for me. And everyone was like, you don't chase money at this point, Asamoah. But he was very adamant in his decision, very, very, stood by his decision with all that he could. And he ended up there, and everyone was skeptical about his form and everything. I remember there was a lot of talk about kicking out for the national team, especially after the semi-final penalty against Gambia that had caused Ghana a great deal in governing the Turkey last day in Africa Cup of Nations. There was talk about his kicking, moving part of Samoa, but he's really coming to his own, Rap. And since going into the new age, Samoa has scored over 60 goals. Can you imagine?
Wow.
60 goals. In the UAE, and you know, Rob, the thing about goal scoring is that it improves your confidence. It makes you feel like you can do anything. And that is what has translated into Asamoah's form with Ghana. I mean, 20 years old, Rob, he scored 9 goals in 10 matches for Ghana. That's his most prolific year in his career. He's now Ghana's all time top scorer. And all this has been achieved through the move to the UAE. I mean, I think he has done a lot for his confidence and about the worry about this not translating into the national, I think he answered it with the goals that he's been scoring over the past few months. He scored 3 goals in the qualifiers for Ghana as part of our 25 goals. And he scored twice against the Egyptians in Kumasi, so none of the teams qualified for the World Cup. And, you know, having a captain armband, you know, there were a lot of concerns expressed, you know, this is the playing the UAE, not playing competitive in coach football. And people were worried about how the player could leave a country like Ghana, which was, you know, coming up as Africa's rising force, and Samoah has proved his wealth. And I think he's doing a great job. I don't think training in the new way will affect the level of competitiveness, because I think he has that confidence going. And he's proven in big games. I mean, when we played England the last time at Wembley, and then we'll go down to the last minute, see that goal he scored, that is Samoah Jan for you. Full of confidence these days, and not afraid to try anything. I remember in 2008, he had a lot of problems. He went out of the team camp during the Ghana Africa Cup of Nations. He hosted that tournament, actually. He left a lot of talent, and people were, you know, cursing him and discouraging him. People were already writing off that he wasn't quite cut out for top level football. I remember, and as a mother, then he was very, very, you know, downhearted. So, 5-6 years old, as a mother, is like, Ghana's top striker. And, you know, if you look at the quality, kind of giving a gap, more than end of most of the players. I mean, looking at Patrick Ryan, Dominica, Lea, Jordan, and you. Asamoah has seen it all. I mean, he's scoring for fun, and I think he'll be key for Ghana in that tournament next year.
All right, last question before we let you go. One of the all-time greats, at least, you know, used to be Michael Essien, of course, from Chelsea right now. We saw him play a couple weeks ago. Got a start in playing under Mourinho, and of course, I think he made a mistake in the first 10 minutes that he played. But still, we know how capable he is. We've seen him do amazing things for Ghana and at the club level. So my question is simple. Does he have enough left in the tank to help Ghana in this World Cup? I mean, are we going to see him in the midfield, or is he going to be the type of guy who comes in the 70th minute? Is he going to start, or what do you expect from him and his role in this year's World Cup?
I think we're talking about Essien here, who's had a difficult time with the Ghana national team over the last 6 to 7 years. I mean, he's had injuries and he missed the most of the 2010 World Cup. He missed the AFCON in 2010 as well. Michael Essien, I had a lot of problems playing for Ghana, and there was that sense of being abandoned at the point. I remember there was a huge debate in Ghana where either for my position or against my position, like Asamoah has divided opinions then, and he had problems at Chelsea on the bench after injury and all that. This is confidence a lot of bad, but he went to Real Madrid, Mourinho encouraged him and all that. That is quite a decent season. He came back to Chelsea, and just when everyone thought Mourinho was going to actually help him kickstart his career once again, this started happening, up until the 8th, 10th mark, I think he hadn't started the match for Chelsea, which was very, very bad. I mean, he didn't confident in a lot of that. But at a certain point during all these struggles, Kessiabi had thought, okay, if Michael decides to come back, I'm going to put him in. I'm going to make sure I help him regain his confidence. I mean, I remember when we were about to play Zambia, Michael was expected to return to the national team, and everyone was like, why is he coming in so late? I mean, that was actually our last game. Second round before qualifying to change it. Everyone was kind of worried about Michael Essien, who was a bit inactive coming back to North Ghana. But I tell you that he came on in that game at the Commander Sports Stadium against Zambia, and everyone was afraid by the sheer confidence on the Ghana side. I feel Essien has a lot of firepower left in it. He's not done yet, he's only 31, he's going to work out in 32. And he won't be his peak workout because he was part of the gold integration that qualified Ghana for that 2006 World Cup. He missed the 2010 World Cup, but would want to make amends in the next year's World Cup. So it won't be his World Cup, his major World Cup before, because today is his career, and he wouldn't want to make this opportunity for him. I feel we have a lot of hunger left in him. We're going to see a lot from Michael Essien, because he has a several part of that squad, actually. Even if Mourinho wouldn't use him, but yes, 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 I love him.
Yeah, I mean, really, really, really the good times at Chelsea. And then, of course, before that, I believe at Lyon, was a really fantastic player. It's hard to believe he's only 31 years old because it seems like he's been around for much longer. I want people to know that they can check out Fifi on Twitter at FIIFIANAMAN. And then, of course, check him out in the Telegraph this summer. And then always be able to check him out at All Sports Ghana, great website for Ghanaian sports. Fifi, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Enjoy the Champions League football right now, and it'd be great to have you back on later.
Thank you, Rob. Nice talking to you.
Thank you. All right, that was Fifi on from Ghana, who's going to be part of the Telegraph's coverage. They have a great section right now, 32 journalists representing 32 countries, and Fifi, of course, writes for Goal Ghana, and All Sports Ghana will be writing for Daily Independent, I believe it's called, The Independent, I believe, out of Ghana. So great to have him in the Ghanaian perspective. Now we're going to mix things around and talk about it in the American. There's no one else to do that with than Zach Lee Rigg, who's now with Univision, producing, writing, going on TV, doing it all. Zach comes on the show a lot. He doesn't need an introduction. Zach, welcome to the program.
Hello, good to be here.
Absolutely. I don't have that much time. A lot of excitement in this group. I'm arguing this is not the group of death. I don't think it's even close to the group of death. I think that's giving too much respect to America. No disrespect to you, Zach.
Well, an interesting point. The American press says this is the group of death. The English press says that their group is the group of death. And the Spanish say that their group is the group of death.
That is an interesting point. Well, Zach, what is the group? Which group is it?
I think that the group of death is a stupid cliche, and I don't care. And that's it. I think there's a couple hard groups, and I think there's a couple of respect there. There's not one that stands out as the definite group of death.
That, you know what, I think you said it the best that anyone could say. It seems ridiculous to argue which group is the group of death. Enjoy and all exciting football we're gonna have. Let's start off with the U.S. draw, of course. and Ghana, Germany, and Portugal, and gave some picks, and we had Portugal really struggled when Ghana over Ronaldo's game, and then you know, it's the 2006, 2010 was Germany. My pick right now to the World Cup. Ghana, United States now two World Cups. Is that something, Zach, that you think is on their minds, the coaching staff minor, or you know, it's a game against a country?
Oh, it's definitely on their mind. That's been a pretty big deal over here talking about the relationship with Ghana, especially because the U.S. team says they want to be able to put. If the U.S. wants to be known as a decent team, they have to be able to beat a team like Ghana. This is a third opportunity in a row to prove they finally do that, whereas they haven't been able to in the past. And the assumption is, if you can beat a Ghana, you don't deserve to make it, because you're not going to win this group.
That makes sense. The Ghanaians are, you know, it's funny. You just was the previous guys before you were saying that actually the Ghanaians are worried the most by Portugal and USA, not Germany, which to me makes absolutely no sense. But he explained how they already think they're going to lose to Germany. They're already focusing on those two games, and they're not about the USA. They're worried about Portugal. They conceded that they're going to lose to Germany. How do you see the fixtures going on? I mean, Portugal can surprise Germany. Do you think it's going to happen with United? How do you see the group playing out? I mean, we know, you know, it's a round robin that each team plays each other, but what's happening?
Well, from the U.S. perspective, they played Germany last.
Right.
So the hope that American fans are clinging to is that by then Germany will already have 6 points, throw in a reserve side, and not care about the final game. It is sort of the one last shred of, you know, hope that they're going to make it through. As far as the Cristiano will go down, Ronaldo drags them, and he showed in Sweden that when he wants to win a game, he can do it single-handedly. As far as like beating a Germany, I'm not sure that they have the full squad depth to do that.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. And it's interesting that you know last game United States versus Germany. The reserves team though is still a very good team. I mean, you have a lot of guys. A lot of these reserves are guys that play on top because in the world, and just, you know, because they're not Schweinsteiger or, you know, all the great players in the team. You know, they're not starting, but they're still great players. I mean, I could got like Lewis Holtby, who you know, probably would be considered part of the reserve team, was on the U21 team this summer, had a fantastic goal for Tottenham. So that the U.S. could still struggle against a reserve team, at least in my eyes, don't you think?
Oh, for sure, for sure. But that's just sort of the hope that, you know, maybe there'll be less chemistry with that team because they haven't played together as much or something like that. But definitely, like, there's no doubt that even that last game against Germany, even if they're already through, will be very, very difficult for this U.S. side.
Now, do you think the United States game versus Ghana being the first in the U.S. play is a good thing to get the jitters out against a team that they want revenge against, as you noted a few minutes ago? Or would you rather have been the middle match? You know, a lot of times you see nations get a little jittery in the first game. You know, it's the World Cup, huge global stage. Or do you think that it's good that in the first game they have to be completely focused? I guess in this group they have to be focused in every game. But still, I mean, would you rather have the Ghana game first, second, or third?
I don't think Jurgen Klinsmann is probably excited just to going. He just wants to go at it from the start. So go from Ghana, beat them, and then you can sort of take what you want in the next two games. I don't ever hinder.
All right, Zach, a big thing that the media is talking about is Klinsmann, of course. And I got to ask you, if Klinsmann fails to get the United States group, is his whole quote-unquote rebuilding project of this, you know, everything from the youth to just everything that he's done, is that considered in the U.S. media? I mean, will people be disappointed? Will understand? And will he be fired if they don't advance to the knockouts?
Yeah, Klinsmann gets $2 million a year. The idea is to make the U.S. competitive in the later stages of the World Cup. Now, he obviously needs to reach those stages first. If he does not make the knockout stages, I think that he will agree that it was a failure. His contract is currently only through this World Cup, so I imagine if he doesn't do this, that he might step aside, or the contract wouldn't be renewed. He said that his difference will actually show between these World Cups. So once he's had a full system, full World Cup cycle, and then in between, that's about when the impact will start to show. Which is an easy thing to say because you can't be judged right away, but it also is a little bit valid that it takes a couple of years to build that sort of culture he wants to.
Alright, and we'll end with this. You know what's coming, you know the predictions are online right now. So we're putting you on the spot and you have the right to change. It'll probably come on the World Cup before the World Cup starts. But as of right now, who's gonna advance in this group?
I say Germany.
Wow, so no United States.
No United States. I don't think they're good enough.
And do you think that can change whatsoever in the next 3 months?
Yes. If Cristiano Ronaldo gets injured, that could change.
All right. Zach Leary, you can check him out on Twitter at Zach, ZACRIGG, and he's a soccer writer for Univision, a great network there in Florida. Zach, always a pleasure. Always look forward to having you on again. And when can people watch your show in the States?
Sunday nights, 10 p.m. on Fusion.
All right. Perfect. Zach, thank you. Have a great day. And we'll speak soon.
Thanks. Talk to you later.
All right, so that was Zach Lee Rigg from Univision out in Miami doing some great stuff there. And we'll be most likely in Brazil for the World Cup, but he doesn't know yet. But a lot of people will be. Our next guest out of Istanbul, probably the closest person that's ever been on the show to me in Tel Aviv, Elliot Rothwell, who writes for the Daily Mirror, of course, in England, and is their man in Istanbul, and also contributes to ESPN FC in addition to going on the radio and speaking at TalkSport and BBC Live. Elliot, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know, it's weird because the Galli-Juventus game was a huge game going into the game, and you were at the game, of course, but the whole significance of the snow and it being played the next day, can you just talk about, you know, what the perspective was like in Turkey from the fans, maybe from the media, and then from the players, and how people, you know, a game getting canceled, abandoned, whatever word you want to use, because of snow in Istanbul. I mean, out of all the places in Europe, it was Istanbul. So just how did that, you know, how did that unfold on the players, the media, and the fans?
Well, it was a big mix of emotions, really. There was sort of, when the orange ball came out first, before the really heavy torrent of snow on the first day of the game, there was a few sort of like excited glances around the press box and in the stands, and then the snow came down further and the reaction was, oh, isn't this magic, like you Champions League game in the snow, it doesn't really happen that often, especially in Istanbul. And then the snow and the hail didn't stop. It was about 15 minutes of a solid hailstorm. You couldn't see the other stand opposite us. And it was becoming increasingly obvious that the referee was going to suspend the game. It wasn't obvious that it was going to be abandoned. I thought that they'd happen now, and how am I going to get home? And luckily, sort of Istanbul's bureaucratic transport base were into gear, and everyone managed to get home okay. The metros ran later and things like that, so all the fans safe. And then the announcements were that it was going to be played the next day at 3 o'clock his time. And it was going to kick ball, have a drop ball from the minute that it stopped, which was the 31st minute. So I think a lot of fans were disappointed. I spoke to a few people who'd come from Ankara just for this game, Galatasaray fans, and obviously they wouldn't be able to see the next day because they'd have to be back in Ankara. A lot of the adults that were there would have had to have been at work because it was at 3 o'clock. And when I got the metro back from, the metro was like sort of near my house, got the metro from my house to the stadium, that it was sort of a big mix of young men and women. There wasn't many older people there, middle-aged people. The sort of demographic seems to be quite young. So I guess the atmosphere was nice the second day, in that it was just a novelty, really, that carried it through.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that something like this would happen in Istanbul. And the pitch, I mean, we saw it on TV, but someone who was there, how bad was the pitch the next day? Just from your eyes, from the press box?
Well, I saw a few images in the morning before I went to the game from various Turkish news sources of the pitch, and the pictures that they took, it looked absolutely awful. Then I got there sort of 2 hours before the game kicked off, went upstairs, had a look at the pitch myself, took a few photos, and it was quite bad at that point as well, and I thought, though, this is going to be a horrible game. The ball's going to get stuck in mud and snow and everything. And then by the time the game kicked off, the weather had improved a little bit. I mean, ironically, the weather worsened 5 minutes after the game kicked off and stayed that way for about 10 minutes. So we got a nice layer of snow again. But the pitch, I don't think it was as terrible as it's been made out. I mean, there was bits from where the TV cameras were to the left of the halfway line that were quite bad, but it was mainly mud rather than ice. The ball, I think it got caught up in the mud maybe twice, but it wasn't sort of a dangerous catch. It was sort of a pass that had slowed down. So I don't really think it was that bad. I mean, obviously Juventus, the natural reaction from them, from Conte, is to not necessarily blame the pitch, but use the pitch as a part of the reason for why they didn't win. But the fact is that they were happy for a 0-0. And when Galatasaray scored, they didn't know what to do because they played for a 0-0 the whole game.
Right, and that's where we're going next. You know, on this program, which is, this is its third season, believe it or not, we've always knocked Mancini for pretty much doing everything in England. I mean, you know, developing the whole club from youth to everything to winning the Premier League, but never being able to get out of the Champions League group stage. Is it kind of ironic that he goes to a Turkish club and does this for the Turkish side, who also did it last year? I mean, were people talking about how, hey, he couldn't do it at City for all those years, or I guess a few years, and then suddenly now he comes to Gala his first season after a legend gets sacked? And you know, I wish we had time to get to that. Maybe next time you come on, we could speak about that. But what was the reaction just from the journalists talking about how he, you know, wow, look, Mancini's taking a team through?
Well, I think it was quite strange in that a lot of the journalists, especially the Turkish ones, conceded that Mancini's probably, he's got through the group stage with his worst team.
Right.
Especially the worst 11 of players that he's had. And he's managed to get through the group stage. I mean, he wasn't very good with Inter, and he had fantastic players. He wasn't very good in the Champions League with City, and obviously they were good enough to win the Premier League, and now they've finally got through the group stage themselves. Tactically, a lot of credit just had to go to Mancini, because he shuffled his part. I mean, since he's came here, and I've been to Galatasaray games, they've made three or four different formations, just in his short time here. And before this game, they'd only had one clean sheet, which was last week. So this is his second clean sheet in a row, and this is his second clean sheet in his whole tenure. And that came about because he, first of all, when he arrived, he started playing in the traditional sort of, for him, 4-3-3, 4-5-1 hybrid. I saw them at Kashin Pasha last week, which ended 1-1. And they played 4-4-2, which worked a bit better because Burak Yilmaz managed to get actually central with Drogba. And then this week, they played a 3-4-1-2, sort of quite Italian, matched up to Juve, and it gave Schneider a little free roll behind Drogba and Yilmaz, and it made Burak Yilmaz central, which worked well. So, and then obviously you saw that come to fruition, the fact that Drogba knocked on the ball for Schneider, who finished for the winner. So quite a lot of credit has gone to Mancini for his tactics. And then there's obviously the irony that Galatasaray are probably the weakest team that he's managed in the Champions League, and it's the first one that he's got through.
Yeah, that's the part that that's pretty funny. We got to talk about Schneider. I mean, you know, a lot of people said that his I don't want to say that his career was over. He's still been in great form with the Dutch team, but that, you know, making a move to the Galatasaray, to the Turkish Premier League, which is a very good league for the people to know. It is a very solid league, but obviously not caliber the same as Spain, Italy, and so on. 29 years old, which it seems like he is older, just because all the great years he had, especially with Ajax, and then the kind of years with Real Madrid, and then of course with Inter, where he was the most successful. This goal, how much do you think it's going to boost his career? I mean, it's a huge goal, might be one of the biggest goals that he scored, at least in a while. It helps, as you said, not the best starting 11 make it to the next round. That's more money for his club. Do you think that they might make some additions now in January to maybe improve this team and somehow have one of these miracle runs? Maybe we saw Malaga make last year an interesting run with not an amazing team, but do you think that now that they're through, they might try and invest in bring in a couple more players like him and Drogba to try and get farther? Or do you think, you know, the management is saying, okay, we made it past the group stages, that's considered a success?
To start with Schneider, I think that this goal especially will be important in endearing him to Galatasaray fans, because obviously it's so important, and he hasn't been fantastic since he came, especially not in the start of this season. But now he's got Mancini there, who obviously, as he showed this week, is willing to
create formation to set up the team around giving Schneider space and giving him freedom. And if that happens, and if Mancini can get Schneider, who I think, I mean, I'm never comfortable saying stuff like this, but he, I think he looked a bit overweight. He doesn't look like he's had a very good preseason. He looked a bit heavy. Obviously, everybody looked heavy yesterday on the pitch, but him especially, he looks slightly unfit, which I don't know whether they'll be able to iron out in time for the next round of the Champions League or whatever. And then on to the signings. I think the most important thing this season, especially with the sort of the disaster in the league as it's been so far, losing to Fenerbahce and trailing them by so many points and sacking Terim as well, is that they're going to have to ensure beyond any doubt that they qualify for the Champions League. Right. I mean, they're third at the minute. Fenerbahce can't qualify for the Champions League because of match-fixing things with UEFA. Fenerbahce are pretty much certain to win the league now. But at the minute, Kashin Pasha are second, which means that they would take the... They would effectively, in the eyes of UEFA, come first. Because, so they would take the group stage, which would be a first for them, which would be quite nice, I think. But then Galatasaray are in third, and they've got to make sure that they stay second or third, which they haven't been that much this season because of their form, to make sure they get into the Champions League. If Galatasaray are going to go further in the Champions League, I mean, on English TV yesterday, there was a huge deal made about the fact that Arsenal didn't finish first in the group and the teams that they can get now in the next round.
Right.
And if you look at the teams who finished first, the seeded teams, there isn't one that you would say you think Galatasaray would be easily, or you think on paper that Galatasaray are better than.
Right.
And obviously, there's a January transfer window coming up, and Mancini, I think, will want to sign defenders because he's always based his teams around being solid at the back and then move forward. And the good thing is for Mancini, I think, this time that he's got three good attacking players in Yilmaz, Drogba and Schneider, which if you can get them to click, they'll be fine. But his defence, and the Galatasaray defence more widely in the whole of the season, looks terrible. It was okay yesterday. There was three at the back. Gökhan Zan, who can't run, but has got a defensive brain. He's quite old now. Looked like he was just guiding Semikaya and Aurelien Tchadjou through the match, which is what they need. But they're also going to need, if they're going to play this 3-4-1-2 formation, they can't play Vieira, left wing back. He's not a left wing back. He's slow now. He was never a left back in the first place. He was always a left winger, and he wasn't particularly great at that. So that's going to be an area where they'll have to sign players centre half and left wing back. But then it's the conundrum of the January transfer window, being in the Champions League, not being able to sign players that have already played in the Champions League and then field them. So it's going to be difficult looking where they can find players from.
All right, I wish we could talk more about Gala, but we only have a couple minutes left. We want to move on to Anzhi, of course, out of the Russian Premier League. We've covered them a lot on the show over the last couple of years. You know, it seems like things were going so well only a couple of years ago. Now, 2 years later, bottom of the Russian Premier League. Everyone seems to be gone who was part of this project. It seems like a long time ago. Yet, despite all of that, they are going to be moving on in Europa League, no matter what the result is tonight against the Spurs, though it should be an exciting match just to see what happens and how they play. With that being said, with you know them playing so poorly in the Russian Premier League and not want to be relegated because that would be really bad, what exactly would you say is their approach now to the Europa League? I mean, do they play their reserves in Europa League even in the next round? I mean, it's a weird thing to say, but isn't the goal here to try and not get relegated and you play your top guys in Russia, or is the goal to try and get as far as you can in the Europa League? Because we all know that they're not that good of a team and that they'll probably just get knocked out in the you know the next round of 32. So what is the you know what does management have to think here? What would you think? How would you analyze this?
It's a painfully difficult one, really. I mean, I think whatever happens, Anzhi will get relegated now. In the form that they're in, they haven't won. The Russian Premier League has been through a whole cycle of games now. So they've played 19 games.
Right. And there's a break. There's like a three-month break now, right?
Yeah. Their next game is against Rubin Kazan in March now. So they've got a break from last weekend until March.
Wow.
So they played played 19 games. The first sort of two or three games was before Suleiman Kerimov removed the finances. And even then they didn't register a win. Even with Eto'o, Willian, Lassana Diarra, Chris Samba, the first two or three games they couldn't register a win. They haven't registered a win all season. 19 games, no wins.
Wow.
They've only got 8 points. And more importantly, well, not more importantly, but more tellingly, they've only scored 12 goals in 19 games.
That is.
So they can't find.
That's horrible.
Yeah, they can't defend. They can't shoot. They can't score. The only hope that they've got is the captain, Dusele, in midfield, is quite a good player. But yesterday, Gaji Gajia, the manager, in a press conference was saying, before the head of this game, saying that they've sort of got two assets left now, which is Dusele and Traore. And one, if not both, of them is pretty much destined to leave in January. So I think that they've accepted, really, which is a horrible thing. They've sort of accepted that they're going to get relegated and just pale back into the obscurity that they came from.
Wow.
So in terms of the Europa League, it looks like at this stage that everything's a bonus.
Huh.
I mean, they've got two wins in the Europa League, which is
impressive.
Well, you can't times zero by anything. It doesn't work. So it's a lot more wins than they've got in the Russian league. So, and they've got a lot of young players now who play up front who aren't very good and will be more suited to life in the Russian championship first division. So it's just a horrible story, really, of what happens when you have a rich owner who sort of pumps up the club, props it up, throws money at it, and then due to sort of wider world economic issues, in this case it was his company fell out of favour with another company that cartel for potash prices, which is a chemical. I'm not exactly sure what potash does, but he lost some of it. I mean, his fortune, Kerimov's fortune, is 4 billion. His personal fortune, I think, he lost 325 million in 2 hours.
Wow.
sort of decided to pull the plug, and as the sort of they obviously recognised that the PR from this was going to be horrible. So they tried to sort of spin it by saying that actually the fact that all these rich, well-paid players are going to leave is good because it means that we can now focus on putting Dagestani-born players into Anji Makhachkala. We can make the club for the fans in the area, and we can try and regenerate the area. But how much of that is just sort of PR fluff? Well, I don't know. But they've certainly gone back to a local manager in Gaji Gajiev, who's been there in a lot of spells now. He's been there many times. He was the manager who was first in charge when Kerimov took over. And it just looks really, really bleak for Anji right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a weird story. The owner of the team, and I'm going to probably pronounce it wrong, but Kerimov, as you said, massive, massive fortune, as a lot of these Russian tycoons have. And we see it with the Brooklyn Nets and the NBA. This was his home team. I mean, this is a team that he grew up rooting for, and he wanted to, you said, make a difference, and he did for a little bit. I mean, they were very competitive for a while, but they completely slashed the budget, and a lot of these players that were on the team have obviously left, and it's amazing how things can change. I mean, 2 years ago, things were, you know, people were excited, and everything was passionate, and they were getting players from all over the world. I mean, literally, it's Belgium, Spain, Italy, Eto'o, I mean, just a lot of big names, and it's just crazy what happens. And from, I think it started, correct me if I'm wrong, in 2011, I think, and now we're in 2013, 2 years later, and it's over. I mean, it's done. So good stuff there. Unfortunately, got to run. I got to get to Bloomfield for Maccabi Tel Aviv Bordeaux. Elliot, where can people check your workout?
Well, in various places, really. My Twitter account is just @ and then my name, and that's where everything gets posted. You can go on the Daily Mirror's website and type in my name, whatever, I'll be there, same with the ESPN. And yeah, that basically Twitter's sort of where everything goes, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I recommend everyone following Elliot. I just started following him about Turkish football, and I've learned a lot. Also Russian football. Elliot, thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy your time in Istanbul and Russia and wherever your travels take you. And I would look forward to having you back on the program sometime soon.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for checking out the show this week. We'll be back next week with a great edition. I just want to note that Zach Lee Riggs' interview is done before the big news on Klinsmann, so please disregard Zach's comments on the latest signing, latest four-year extension for the United States coach. Thank you so much for listening. Check me out on Twitter at RafaelG23. Have a great week and speak next week.